Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Tuesday, October 30th, and we're safe, warm, and dry here on the left coast.
Sandy, the fireworks are hailing over Little Eden tonight.
Hurricane Sandy spared Asbury Park, New Jersey, from what I can tell. But it did wreak havoc on New York City, on Long Island, and portions of New Jersey, including the area near Newark. And I have followed the coverage, but not nearly as closely as people much nearer to the scene. And I don't pretend to have anything exclusive about the storm itself, or the massive damage that it's caused. But from the graphic pictures that I've seen of flooded subways, of cars that were jammed together, both on the street and in parking garages, this is a massive storm, and I have great empathy for the people who have been harmed by it. Many people have died. The count was moving up in the 30 to 40 range the last time I checked, and certainly it's likely that more people will die from this storm. And as it moves inland, it's going to dump a lot of precipitation, some of it in the form of snow, on inland areas as well. So I, as somebody who's been through earthquakes and many other kinds of natural disaster, I just want to extend my heart to those who are still suffering from this. And we know that cell phone service in much of Manhattan, that power outages across New England, will remain for some time. And I just think how long it will take for the subways to dry out so that everything from the electric trains to the turnstiles are working once again. And so to see a storm of this magnitude visit such damage on the most populous area of the United States is really heartbreaking and breathtaking all at the same time. And, of course, you and I know that this is a product of climate change, of global warming. And it reminded me, and I'm sure I'm not alone, of the 2004 film The Day After Tomorrow. And I can still vividly remember that ship that found itself on Fifth Avenue right outside of the New York Public Library. And that was Dennis Quaid and Jake Gyllenhaal, if you remember. And it was a warning that was missed, even on the big screen with lots of Hollywood production values. And that opening scene where the Antarctic ice flow just cracked open. And I give them high marks for the special effects. But the United States has been in the grip of paid denialists ever since, and our political leaders are hamstrung by it. Barack Obama said that he was going to make climate change a signature issue of his first term, and he, as far as I know, has only even referred to it twice in the past year, once in the State of the Union message and once at the convention in Charlotte during his acceptance speech. And Mitt Romney is even more of a booster of the the inaccurately labeled clean coal than Obama is. And Obama hasn't been in the way of the coal industry. The EPA put some limitations on smokestack emissions, and that is viewed as a war on coal. Everything's a war these days, isn't it? And Mitt Romney's out there cheerleading for coal, and it is one of the major drivers of CO2 in the atmosphere. And the fact that we have done nothing, even if we just peg it to 2004 in that film, which is hardly pivotal, but we've ignored the work of the UN Climate Change Organization, and we're actually in worse shape than after Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth documentary. And so, in the aftermath, we have to offer at least some feeble praise for billionaire Michael Bloomberg, who doesn't owe his office to the oil or coal industries and could say the dreaded words, climate change. New York State Governor Andrew Cuomo said that it's obvious that weather patterns are changing, but at least in the clip I saw, he couldn't bring himself to utter the words, climate change. And so it goes. Now, one of the issues that still concerns me is the nuclear power plants in the range of Hurricane Sandy. The nation's oldest nuke plant declared an alert, and a second plant just 40 miles from New York City was forced to shut down as five different nuke plants in Hurricane Sandy's path experienced problems during the storm. Indian Point in Buchanan, New York, on the Hudson River north of the city, automatically shut power to its Unit 3 on Monday night as a result, quote, of an electrical grid disturbance, according to Entergy, the plant's operator. And they also declared an alert at the second oldest nuclear plant, Oyster Creek in Lacey Township, New Jersey, on Monday evening. And one of the issues that we've learned from Fukushima is that the direct impact on a facility like the earthquake and tsunami that hit in Japan is the first phase of damage and concern. But we also have to look at the spent fuel that is stored on site and that requires massive cooling systems, generally with water, and those are powered by electricity. And when you shut down the nuke and when the weather interrupts the power on the grid, you have to make sure that the cooling is maintained. Now, we're led to believe that generators kicked in and that, as they've always told us, going back to Three Mile Island, that the public is not in any danger. But people in Manhattan are still in the throes of an electrical blackout, and a report that cell phone coverage and service is down in many parts of Manhattan. And this leaves people isolated and unable to not only call friends and family, but also call for emergency services as needed. And this does, fortunately, draw more attention to the long-term debate about the role of government and the role of the federal government in the case of these massive disasters. And Hurricane Katrina didn't limit its damage to New Orleans. Neither did Hurricane Sandy limit its damage to one particular jurisdiction or state. And this is embarrassing for Mitt Romney, who said back in the primary, when he was asked about FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, and, should it be eliminated? Should it be this function of disaster relief be returned to the states? Absolutely, he said. Every time you have an occasion to take something from the federal government and send it back to the states, that's the right direction. And if you can go even further and send it back to the private sector, that's even better. So he advocates for profiteering on the backs of a natural disaster. And he himself is busy collecting canned food and blankets and other supplies in Ohio, the battleground state, as he attempts to make some political hay out of this disaster in the Northeast. And as a former governor of Massachusetts and a guy who has a nice lake house in New Hampshire, he should be a little more sensitive. Reports are that he has called only Republican governors like big old Chris Christie, and not people like Andrew Cuomo. And frankly, his call would be a distraction. But the tokenism of it is not lost. And to collect canned goods in Ohio and attempt to send it into the disaster zone is also more of a complication. They should be raising cash, including from Mitt Romney's $20 million a year income, to send so that the resources that are needed can be fit to local requirements instead of, trying to make photo ops as a concerned American. So I think that this does help frame the campaign, and likewise, I don't seek to make political gains off of a natural disaster. And it does raise the question, where's Brownie? Michael Brown, who was Bush's FEMA director, whose credentials, I believe, were owning racehorses stud horses of some sort. Well, fortunately, he's nowhere near FEMA or the disaster zone. He's now safely hosting or co-hosting a radio talk show in Denver. And I want to give a shout out to David Sirota. I've met him a couple of times, don't know him well, but I deeply respect his work and admire his independent voice. And to see that that poor guy is saddled 3 or 4 hours a day in a radio studio trying to offset or balance the ravings of Michael Brown, well, that's a special kind of disaster patrol all of its own, and David Sirota deserves a couple of extra stars for that. Turning now to the mostly contrived controversy over the response to the attack on September 11th of this year on our consulate in Benghazi, Libya, the New York Times gives us a more detailed picture of the warnings that allegedly came from the scene to the State Department and whether or not the White House was paying attention. And it does appear that the White House did not know of the risks to security. They may have been aware that in June there was a string of assassinations and attacks on a Red Cross and a British envoy's motorcade. And the late Ambassador Chris Stevens emailed his superiors in Washington last August, alerting them to a security vacuum in Benghazi. And the response was to harden the facility. They ran concertina wire around the fence. They put up these concrete barriers to prevent a car bomb from getting too close to the consulate. But it's fair to say that no one expected this kind of a coordinated assault on the Benghazi facility. And the opportunism of Republicans, starting with Mitt Romney, hours after the attack, before he even knew or we even knew that the ambassador and three others had been killed, are really reprehensible. And likewise, the political posturing of Daryl Issa at the House Oversight Committee is clearly intended to score political points around a tragic international event that could have greater implications. But I still have to point out that the Obama administration is hiding something. And that's what feeds the frenzy on the right to see if they can undermine the president's perceived strength in foreign policy by embarrassing him or shaming him about this episode. And we still have the inexplicable position of UN Ambassador Susan Rice, who was maintaining well after, now that the record has been released, it was known that this was not some sort of spontaneous event. So it's a mixed bag. I don't think that there is a smoking gun that the Republicans have been looking for. And they, for example, take the comments of one State Department security officer who had been in Benghazi for a month up through the 5th of July. His name is David Oliveira. And they take some things that he reports he was thinking about, okay? He told Daryl Issa's committee that he recalled thinking that if 100 or more assailants sought to breach the mission's walls, there was nothing we could do about it because we just didn't have the manpower, we just didn't have the facilities. Now, the fact that somebody was thinking about that in July is hardly an indictment of the response by the government and the Obama administration. And that's the kind of very thin beef that the Republicans try to turn into a rib roast. And I think it's pretty pathetic. And so we'll see how all this plays out. But I think that perhaps the political firestorm is petering out in much the way we hope Hurricane Sandy will. And also over the weekend was an alleged ceasefire during the Eid holiday, EID, in Syria. And unfortunately, during the ceasefire, 500 people were killed. And the death toll was, for what was supposed to be a four-day ceasefire, is exceeding 500. And activists believe that the government's heavy reliance on air power reflected its inability to roll back rebel gains on the ground. And I want to note that I don't comment every day about Syria because it's kind of an endless loop of carnage. And I have pointed out, I hope you've heard my comments, that we don't know who all the forces on the ground there are. And Pepe Escobar told us in our recent interview about a week ago that there is an array of foreign fighters, some of whom are believed to be directed by the CIA and Mossad. But we have no real idea who the Free Syrian Army includes. And, of course, once the end game plays out, and I do believe that at some point Bashar al-Assad will be forced from power, but perhaps tens of thousands of more innocent Syrians will die before that occurs. And then we have to figure out what happens next. And again, this is one of those problems where you blow the lid off a brutal dictatorship over a multicultural society, and inevitably a civil war will occur. And as we've discussed here before, the role of the Kurds, who occupy part of northern Iraq, part of southern Turkey, and part of northern Syria, their desire for a unified Kurdistan, I think, will be one of the powerful drivers of any post-war scenario in Syria. And just down the road in Bahrain, the little country that is a royal, what do you call it? It's a kingdom. It's run by a small family group that is a religious minority compared to the population, which is primarily Shiite. So this Sunni-led monarchy has been facing protests since the so-called Arab Spring revolts. But we've left Bahrain out of the U.S. support for Arab Spring. I guess it's a different kind of climate change, eh? And now the royal rulers there have announced that there shall be no more protests whatsoever. Now, over 50 people have died in the protests and the aftermath, some of those police officers. It's been about 21 months, since those protests began. And the U.S. is generally silent about the plight of the people of Bahrain, about their desire to overthrow the monarchy and allow the Shiite leadership there, the Shiite majority population, to take control. And, of course, it's a geopolitical nightmare because we have the Saudis, who are neighbors of Bahrain, who rolled tanks and troops and cops in to send a message to Washington not to mess with them. And, of course, we have our Fifth Fleet based in the Persian Gulf Kingdom. And then there is Iran, just a few clicks down the road. And they, of course, would support a Shiite takeover of control. And that makes for a very complicated picture. Here in San Francisco, after the Giants won the World Series, even though the game was played in Detroit, there are a lot of people out on the streets, and some went to the Civic Center where they watched the game on a big screen TV. And a couple of hours later, about midnight or just after, there were groups of roving celebrants who crossed over to become anarchist or rioting gangs. And they burned a muni bus. They also jumped on some cars. They set fires on garbage bins. And I just have to scratch my head because I don't understand why the reaction to a sports victory, whether it is the NBA, the NFL, or Major League Baseball, leads these people to act in this manner. Now, certainly a lot of it is fueled by alcohol, but much of it is, I guess, a kind of copycat behavior. And I just don't get it. Well, the latest polling here in California related to the ballot initiatives is causing some concern. And let me recap on just a few issues here. If you did not listen, I put up a podcast about a week ago in our free news and comment podcast section with my analysis and picks for the ballot propositions in California this year. So if you haven't voted yet and you want to hear my views on that, please download that podcast and it will help you a little bit in sorting through these complex initiatives. Now, Proposition 30, which is California's own hostage-taking fiscal cliff, is now trending downward, and it's below 50%. One poll shows it at 49.0, the opposition at 41.2, and that leaves 8.7% undecided. And this is the one that would cause massive cuts, particularly to education, to social safety net programs, and even to things like the operation of the courts here in California, if it doesn't pass. And as I've mentioned, I don't like the whole way it was set up, because our current year budget relies on voters approving these tax increases, and that's a really risky way to operate. As I've said, the governor and the Democrats were forced into this risky proposition because of the opposition of obstructionist Republicans, who are much more committed to Grover Norquist than they are to the people of California. Now, Proposition 32, which is the so-called paycheck protection, it bans political contributions by payroll deduction, and this applies almost only to unions. It is written in such a way that it excludes corporate interests and the super PACs, whether they are at the federal level like Karl Rove or at the state level. And just in the past week, because of the television advertising, much of it funded by Charlie Munger, who is the son of one of Warren Buffett's business partners and has oodles of money, as a result of that effort, the support for Proposition 32 has grown, and it's up to 42%. And the no vote, which is what I advocate, is now sitting at 46%. Now, fortunately, 11% are undecided, but typically, the last-minute vote goes in the wrong direction. And so I'm very concerned about that one. The death penalty repeal, likewise, is now trending to fail. It's at only 43.5%. The no vote on ending the death penalty is just a point higher at 44%. We've got 12% undecided. But as these issues go, the conservatives tend to win out in the split of the undecided vote leading up to and including Election Day. So I'm very concerned about that one. And I, of course, think that it's a no-brainer to end the death penalty here in California. And the three strikes reform is looking very good, 67% still supporting that. There hasn't been a huge amount of advertising against it. The other troubling measure is the very simple proposition to require labeling on food products that contain GMOs, genetically modified organisms. And it was trending to pass just a month ago with 60% support. It then went up a little bit because of the $41 million in negative and deceptive advertising funded by Monsanto and its allies. The no vote has risen, and it brings Prop 37 support down below 50%. And again, because of the onslaught of these outright lies on television, and it showed up in the World Series broadcast quite a bit, I'm concerned that this common sense food labeling measure may go down by a very narrow margin. So if you haven't voted, or if you're thinking about not voting, can I ask you to get your butt out there, fill in that absentee ballot and mail it or deliver it? And if not, go to the polls on next Tuesday, because these measures, I think, are very important, and we cannot let the forces of reaction win out on these important issues. And finally today, I have not visited the Borowitz Report in ages, and now I find out that it is housed at the New Yorker magazine. Good for you, Andy. I've met Andy a couple of times. He's a very clever guy and manages to pump out a daily humor piece that is always really on topic. So we'll close with this. Hitting the campaign trail one day after the arrival of Superstorm Sandy, Republican nominee Mitt Romney tweaked his position on abortion, saying he now supports it in cases where it makes people vote for him. Quote, I would make an exception for abortion in cases where the life of my campaign is at stake, he told a crowd in Kettering, Ohio. Sandy, which slammed into the East Coast last night with such a powerful weather system that it prevented Mr. Romney from changing his position on abortion for 24 hours. Quote, it was important for Mitt to come up with a new position on abortion today, said his campaign manager, Matt Rhodes. It sends a message to the American people that in the aftermath of Sandy, things are getting back to normal. Mr. Romney made no reference to his comments about eliminating FEMA, which have been declared a disaster area. Best wishes to those affected by Sandy, and thanks for listening. Please share this podcast as far as you'd like.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.